Again.
Thank you, David. I'm not going to attempt to answer all of your questions because there's not time. In particular, I'm not going to attempt to discuss how reactors are supposed to work. Reactors are supposed to do a certain thing, and they're supposed to produce power in a certain way, and they're supposed to regulate that power in certain ways, and they're supposed to not blow up. That's a little irrelevant now, so I'm just going to leave it aside in the case of Fukushima. The thing that's relevant now is that these reactors are leaking radioactivity. Radioactivity is a very scary thing for many people. I think that's what's important in the near term. That's what's important for the people of Japan, and many people are concerned about whether or not it's important for us. The main thing I want to talk about is what is the radioactivity that's coming out of these reactors? Why is it in there to begin with? How does it affect you if it gets to you? How does it get to you? How does it get out? We'll talk about the implications of some of that. I recognize there's a bunch of actual physicists in the audience. This is not a talk for physicists. This is a talk for the general public. Physicists have their own ways of figuring out what a microsievert is. This is for the rest of you. To understand where radioactivity is going, we have to look at different radioactive elements. Different radioactive elements are going to behave different ways depending on their chemical properties. This should be familiar to you because this is the table used by the California Department of Education. Hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and so on, all the way up to uranium, plutonium. Some of the elements that you'll be hearing about in the news on a regular basis are things like iodine, cesium, tritium. The reason you're hearing about them is not that iodine is inherently dangerous. You probably dealt with iodine in your high school chemistry labs. There are isotopes of iodine that behave just like regular iodine, except that they're radioactive. Likewise for hydrogen. There's an isotope of hydrogen which is radioactive and fairly hazardous, and so is cesium. In terms of understanding what they do, that's a job for chemistry. We'll be going back and forth between the nuclear side and the chemical side. For the nuclear side, why is some hydrogen safe and other hydrogen dangerous? Well, the thing that defines it as hydrogen is that it has just one proton and therefore one electron. That's what gives it the chemistry that you associate with hydrogen. That's what makes it able to go into H2O, this kind of thing. But that doesn't define the number of neutrons. You can take that one proton and have it all by itself, in which case it's the hydrogen that you mostly know and love. Or you can add a neutron to it, or you can add two neutrons to it, and then it becomes radioactive. That doesn't change the chemistry at all. It still behaves like hydrogen. In order to understand the radioactive side of it, we have to go to a different graph where we have a place to put the neutron number. What I'm going to show you now is we're going to unwrap this and just list the elements in order on the vertical axis. Here's hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. Stack them up. There's no periodicness about this. We're just going to list them in order. That's the number of protons. In this axis, we're going to represent the number of neutrons. Normal hydrogen, H1, is just one proton all by itself. H2 is what happens when you add a neutron. Hydrogen 2 is also known as deuterium. Both of these are drawn in black because they're stable. They're safe. They're not radioactive elements. If you add that third neutron, we change color to green, representing radioactivity. Tritium is H3. It's got two neutrons and one proton, adding up to three. This number is the total. It's a heavy isotope of hydrogen. It is radioactive. The same sort of pattern is true of everything in the periodic table. All of these nice, familiar, happy elements like helium, lithium, beryllium have the safe, familiar elements, the safe, familiar isotopes that you've seen before. If you add a couple of neutrons to them, you get this short-lived radioactive stuff that's going to emit particles as it decays. It also happens if you remove neutrons from them, you get other radioactive particles, but that's almost totally irrelevant here. Those are very rare in nature. Here's this line of stability. We're going to zoom in on this in a couple of different ways. One thing to look at is where do things decay? When tritium decays, this is H3, that tritium, it goes to helium-3. It just wants to change a proton into a neutron. Sorry, it changes a neutron into a proton because it has, remember, all this stuff has too many neutrons. It's all neutron-rich. I'm going to zoom out again. Here's that same chart, hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon, so on, vanadium, and so on, and uranium will be up there somewhere. Here's that vast universe of either short-lived radioactive or less short-lived radioactive, and then here's this nice line of stable stuff. Anything that you could possibly manufacture over here is going to be radioactive in some way. If you make it's going to decay by going hop, 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 hop until it gets to something stable. This is the majority of the radiation you're hearing about already at the Fukushima reactor accident. It may not be the majority of the radiation that you hear about in the future, depending on how fires and things go. I'm going to zoom out one more time to show you the whole table. So this is practically every nuclide we've ever seen in nature or made in a lab, ranging from hydrogen way down here in the corner. There's hydrogen 2, there's deuterium, tritium, and you stack them up all the way here until you get to lead. So that's the valley of stability. Those are all the stable isotopes, and that's the vast majority of what you experience in daily life, for this black line running up the middle of this thing. If you have lots of protons, you generally have to have lots of neutrons. The relationship's not quite 1-to-1. It's not one neutron per proton. Over here, it's more like 1.2. Excuse me. See, look up here. There's something funny going on up here. This is a very interesting region of the chart, because I said this is hydrogen through lead, maybe bismuth, depending how you're counting. There's a gap, nothing stable, and then suddenly there's uranium, thorium, plutonium, the fuel for reactors. This is stuff that's stable enough that nature has given us big piles of it. There is a lot of uranium on Earth. It's actually not uncommon at all. And it's been sitting around since the birth of the planet, 4 billion years ago. I actually have a bit of it here. Here it is. This is a bit of uranium ore, very low level. This is, I think, a kilobecquerel or so. I'll explain what that unit is in a minute, and that'll explain why I'm not afraid of it. In this case. So what you do when you're building a reactor is you dig up a bunch of uranium, you put it in a box, and there's some complications. It's the simple. And then you try to make it fission, which means you hit it with neutrons. Brushing every possible detail under the rug. Fissioning a uranium atom is splitting it in half. You take this one giant nucleus, you kind of make it go bleb in the middle, and it splits into two big nuclei. Not of exactly the same size. There's usually a bigger one and a smaller one. And there's often a couple of neutrons that pop out too. But for the most part, you're dividing the protons and the neutrons in half, and you're making two things with half the neutrons and half the protons. But look, if you divide these numbers in half, and I'm following a straight line down here, you don't end up on the stable line. Fission does not produce stable isotopes immediately. It produces very neutron-rich isotopes, often very, very neutron. Some of the richest neutron things you can make outside of a very specialized circumstances. So when you're running a fission reactor, this is what you want to do. This is where you get all your power, and this is where you get a bunch of radioactive waste. It doesn't stay there forever, because remember, this stuff's all unstable, and unstable means it decays, which means it moves that way, moves back to the line of stability over various time scales, sometimes seconds, sometimes years, sometimes thousands of years. And once those nuclei have reached the line of stability, they're stable. Stable nuclei, just like the ones you're used to. Indeed, most of the nuclei that you're made of, most of the nuclei in your body or in your environment that are heavier than iron, at one point in their history, were some horrible radioactive thing on this side of the chart. All of the gold in your wedding ring was, 4 billion years ago, was a pile of radioactive iridium, and then it decayed into gold. So these products are really perfectly safe once they've decayed. The problem is getting in there. So that's the reactor's job. That's where you get all the power from. It's where you get most of the power from. About 95% of your power comes from that fission process, and then another 5% comes from the final walking back slowly to the line of stable isotopes. The other thing to note, remember that this axis of the chart was hydrogen, helium, lithium, and so on, up to uranium up here. So when I draw these blobs, that spans a whole lot of elements. That's everything, almost everything from krypton up to what, gadolinium or something. So there's a vast swath of the periodic table represented chemically here. So if you want to control these things chemically, you have to know what they are. Well, they're everything. There's all kinds of materials in here. So that's some of the radioactivity of a reactor, not all of it. The other thing you have is that uranium and plutonium and whatever is sitting there in your reactor core, the stuff that you wanted to fission, doesn't all fission. Sometimes the uranium atom will capture a nucleus and not fission, which changes it from uranium into something else, which then decays, and you can capture a neutron into that. And so there's a bunch of neutron shuffling around that happens up here. We call it neutron capture on fuel. I don't know what it's called technically. And you end up with kind of a smear of stuff in the vicinity of uranium, and that piles up in your reactor. That's mostly what we call minor actinides. Also radioactive, because that's all, it's not those couple of nice black stable dots in the uranium area. It's all the stuff around it, because the neutrons shuffled things from place to place. the third way of getting radioactivity in a reactor context is that you have all these neutrons flying around. They don't just hit the uranium, they also hit, you know, the steel and the water and the nitrogen and everything else. So neutron capture on other materials can make a bunch of induced radioactivity. And if you're actually working in a nuclear power plant, or working in a radiation environment generally, this is what gives you most of your headaches, because this is kind of on things that you're not normally being very far away from. You know, if your pump is radioactive, if your valves are radioactive, it's because of stuff like this, and that takes a lot of work. But it's not most of the radioactivity. Most of the radioactivity that's actually in the fuel is in this stuff up here. And that radioactivity is releasing energy. We want it to release energy because we want power from this fission process. But let's look at how that energy is released and understand how it's harmful. So there are basically two kinds of radiation damage that we worry about when we encounter radioactive elements. There's alpha decay and there's beta-gamma decay. If you're at Chernobyl, you also worry about neutrons, but we're not at Chernobyl, and Fukushima should not be emitting neutrons anymore. So here's a nucleus, a nice big fat one, 222 radon. It's up there with the minor actinides, although it's not technically an actinide. This is something we encounter very commonly in research contexts. And when it decays, it does this. Let me see if my animation works. It spits out a helium-4 nucleus, commonly called an alpha particle. But it's just a helium-4 nucleus, two protons, two neutrons. And that nucleus is highly charged. It's moving fairly fast, but not super fast. And it turns out that gives it a very high probability of damaging anything it passes. It's crashed into my label up here. A good way to, if you want a pretty good estimate of what happens when an alpha particle goes through your body, which would happen if you had some radon sitting in your lungs or in your skin, draw a line from that particle, count every 10th atom that line goes through. Every 10th atom is going to be altered in some way. It could be ionized, could have a chemical bond broken, be turned from a nice stable thing into a free radical. So that's one of the ways that radiation damage happens. And it happens all in a clump, because the alpha stops pretty fast. Lots of damage in a short distance. It also doesn't go that far, because it's wasting all its energy on every 10th atom. The other kind of decay that we worry about is relevant for fission products particularly, which is beta decay. So here's a carbon-14 nucleus. Carbon-14 is a little to the right, you're right, of this line of stability. So it has too many neutrons. It wants to get rid of one. It's going to do that by turning a neutron into a proton and emitting an electron. And it saddens me to say this, but it also emits a neutrino. And if there weren't reactors blowing up, I'd be spending all my time studying neutrinos. But and it really pains me to say this. Ignore the neutrino. It doesn't do anything. We have to pay attention to the electron. The electron is what's coming out of this thing really fast, and it has all these interactions, so it's going to crash into stuff and damage it. That's beta radioactivity, and that is the majority. That's a very large, substantial part of what you get from fission products. Beta decays do not damage everything they pass. They're not as interactive as alpha particles. Well, I don't know what the word is. Rough estimate, every 1,000th or 3,000th particle along the path of a beta will be ionized, chemical bonds broken, that kind of thing. So those are the forms of radiation damage. Gamma decay is something that looks, from a nuclear physics standpoint, looks totally different than beta decay. It's just an excited nucleus de-exciting. From a radiation safety point of view, it looks exactly like beta decay, because the nucleus de-excites and a gamma ray comes out. It hits an electron, and thereafter the electron looks just like this one. So beta, gamma, from a radiation safety standpoint, exact same thing. Oh, man. But the nuclear physics is much more interesting on one side. So how much damage do you get? This is my radiation numeracy lecture. To understand radiation, you need to understand radiation units, and they're a mess. These are the worst units in all of physics. You want stat coulombs. I'll give you stat coulombs. This is terrible. How much damage do you expect from a given amount of radiation? There are lots of different ways to measure that, and you will see all of them in the New York Times. I think I've seen all of these in the news in the past couple of days. A becquerel is just a count. How many decays are happening per second? It's like 1 hertz in radioactivity units. So 1 decay per second, that means you've got a becquerel. This thing I just put in my pocket is probably about a kilobecquerel. Kilo is 1,000, so it's 1,000 decays per second. little lump of very weak uranium ore. I'll take it out of my pocket though. And that's a useful unit for some things. A curie is the same thing, just multiplied by 37 billion. And you will see both these units. Becquerel is very frequently expressed when you're looking at radioactive fallout. People say, oh, there's a kilobecquerel per square meter of cesium on the ground. That's an amount. If you could take that number and the half-life and some other stuff, you could turn that into grams or moles or kilograms or any of those sort of amount units that you're used to. This is a quote from a recent Times article. There are 20 million curies of cesium-137 in the fuel pond. That's the kind of thing you'll see. That's not useful for thinking about hazards. Well, there are a bunch of steps before you can think about hazards from curies. Thinking about hazards, you want to know, you know, you say, I don't care how much radiation it is. What I want to know is how many chemical bonds in my body were broken. So we've got this unit called the gray, which is, let's see. This is how I translated it this morning. This sounds confusing now. If you imagine having a billion U-238 decays per gram of your body, sounds like a lot, right? That's a gray. So a gray sounds like a large number for starters. Cesium is that's an alpha decay. This is a beta decay. It's one of those electron ones. It's a weaker decay, so 10 billion cesium-137 decays would also be a gray. And that's per gram. So you can get a gray in your hand, or you can get a gray in your thyroid, or you can get a gray in your whole body, depending on what the dose is. Depending on what's going on, and it's really a pretty good count of just how many bonds were broken total. A complication is that some bond breaking is more effective at damaging, say, DNA. An alpha particle is a much better tool for smashing up DNA molecules than a beta particle. So we came up with this other unit, which is the same thing as a gray, except that you count alpha particles a factor of 20 higher. So if you want to translate it into number of decays, it looks like this, again, per gram of body mass. And so think of this as how many bonds were broken in my body, what fraction of my body's bonds were broken, maybe? And think of this as what fraction of my body's DNA molecules were damaged, because they're weighted differently. And so with that introduction, when we're talking about fission products, they're the same thing. So forget all this. But you'll see both of them in a time, so, I mean, translate one to the other. Notice this is a decays per second. This is just a total. This is a integrated amount. I'll give you an example of this is joules per kilogram in physics terms. What you want to have is some intuition for which of these are bad, which are less bad. Is a curie a big number? I mean, a curie of tritium I would happily put in a test tube in my pocket. It's not that much. A curie of strontium-90 I would not stand across the room from. Curies of different things can be scary or not scary. So this is not the most useful unit. Useful unit for figuring out what's scary and what's not are the gray and the sieverts. Let's go on to that. So you are all getting irradiated right now, and it's not the fault of my uranium. If you've eaten a banana recently, you've got some potassium-40 in your body. It's just a natural component of all potassium. Your dose from a normal body load of potassium is about 0.2 millisieverts per year. Everybody remembers what a milli is? It's a 1/1000th. So a thousandth of a sievert per year you're getting just from your own potassium, some of which is radioactive, gamma decay, beta gamma, rather. The air around us has some radon-222 in it. That's an alpha decay. Sometimes that radon that's drifting around the air will find itself in your lungs at the moment when it's decaying. That's about a millisievert per year for all of you. Cosmic rays are raining down on us from the upper atmosphere, muons passing through your whole body, nice straight lines. Beautiful particles, but they're about a millisievert per year. Move to Denver, you can double that, higher altitude. Are you a flight attendant? You can multiply that by another factor of two or so. You're above the atmosphere all this time, you're getting extra radiation. So, I mean, if a friend of yours tells you that they're moving to Denver, you don't say, oh my God, you're going to get an extra millisievert. So this is, and as well you shouldn't. So this is part of the radiation numeracy. A few millisieverts is not really worth worrying about. It's not something that we have any evidence for harm for, and it's something that we tolerate huge variations in daily life. This is a plot I got from a photograph from a book. These are natural backgrounds in some horrible unit. Oh yeah, this is, so these are, don't worry about this, but this is, if you live in the UK, your total dose is about 1.5 millisieverts per year. If you live in Finland, it's about 7. So if you're not terrified by that difference, you shouldn't be terrified by some other source of a millisievert. So let's look at something scarier, which is a sievert. Sievert's 1,000 times that the thing I told you should ignore. When we get to sievert scales, we're talking about maybe worrying about risk of cancer from the radiation. How is it cancer? Well, you get this ionization, which sometimes, not every particle will do this, but once in a while, a radioactive particle will happen to hit some DNA and damage it. Sometimes when DNA is damaged, the cell can't repair it, and it does something, it's a useful part of the DNA, and so it changes the way the cell behaves. Sometimes when the behavior of the cell is changed, instead of just the cell dying, which is probably more common, sometimes the cell becomes cancer. So that's how you can turn billions and billions of ionization events, very rarely leads to cancer. And the numbers I could find on that are this. This is a very interesting set. One sievert of dose given to 1,000 people, so 10,000 people getting a sievert each. Here's a list of cancers, and here's how many extra cancer diagnoses there would be per year in that 10,000 people. And the extra diagnoses per year. Now remember, there's already radiation or no radiation, there are lots of diagnoses of leukemia, breast cancer, thyroid cancer. These are the extra ones. Leukemia, 3 extra cases. Breast cancer, 7 extra cases. Thyroid cancer, 1.5 extra cases. Stomach cancer, 5 extra cases. Now that's not insubstantial risk. But nor is it you've just dropped dead. I was trying to find something to compare this to, and I'm not sure I have the numbers exactly right. There's not good data on this, but I think that's about the same risk as texting while driving. If you habitually send SMS messages while driving, you are accepting a risk comparable to a sievert of radiation. So let's think about, so compare this to a millisievert. A sievert is something that you should go quite out of your way to avoid. But it doesn't drop you dead on the spot, nor does it just give you cancer on the spot. I should add there's a big difference between a sievert, all at once, like from a nuclear explosion, and a sievert given over a week or a month, a little bit at a time. A sievert all at once will give you radiation sickness right away, and your cancer risk will come later. And I should point out the reason we know this is a very unusual case. The reason we know this much about radiation doses at this scale is this is a common radiation dose for the population of Hiroshima survivors, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that is a data source for understanding radiation illness. It doesn't happen very often to statistically large populations. The other population that gets this scale of a dose is if you have cancer in one part of your body, you're getting radiation therapy. The radiation therapy is really intense on the cancer, and you're trying to kill the cells of the cancer itself, and sometimes that bleeds out, and a really serious, a solid course of radiotherapy may give you a sievert in the rest of your body. So we have data from that also. Acute radiation sickness, the kind of radiation that will just kill you, is of order 5 sievert, 5 or more. Extraordinarily rare, there's only handfuls of events where this has happened. Other than, so Hiroshima and Nagasaki, obviously. Among Chernobyl first responders, a great many of them just faced absolutely inhuman risks to put out the fires at Chernobyl. 30 dead, 200 hospitalized in that group. Many with people over 10 sieverts per hour carrying around pieces of reactor core in their hands on a roof. No protection of equipment. The Guyana accident was a very, very interesting case. A big medical source, big strontium-90 source, I think, got loose at a recycling plant, and townspeople somehow got a hold of this pretty blue metal and were playing with it. And that led to 4 deaths, 15 hospitalizations. Over 5 sieverts, all cases were deaths. So this is 5 sieverts is run for your life. So that's your introduction to... This actually, it's an interesting case. The people with equivalent doses, 5 sieverts, they were all dead. The 3 to 4 sieverts case, people who got it all at once died. People who had it spread over a week, in this case, survived. It makes a big difference. So here's some units in the news. New York Times. This is yesterday. I haven't had time to follow the news today. This is probably all different. Last defense at troubled reactors. 50 Japanese workers. Radiation close to the reactors was reported to reach 400 millisieverts per hour. Millisieverts per hour is a very common measure you'll see associated with a place. If I tell you there's a millisievert per hour over there, it means that if I go over there and stand there for an hour and then go away, I've got 1 millisievert. If I stood there for 2 hours, I've got 2 millisieverts. So you need to multiply by time. So let's see. So we know 5,000 millisieverts. 5,000 times the milli gives 5. So that's 5 sieverts will kill you. So 400 millisieverts per hour will kill you in 12 hours. This rate wasn't, well, reportedly was not that high for 12 hours, but you know, so there's something you can understand about that number. After a blast inside reactor number 2 and a fire at number 4, but has since dropped back to as low as 0.6 millisieverts at the plant gate. 0.6 millisieverts per hour, let's compare that to texting while driving. If you stood at that gate for 2 months, you'd get a sievert at that rate. So, I mean, there are very different scales involved here. You know, death in half a day versus inconvenience and risk of cancer in over a month. Here, World Nuclear News is reporting microsieverts, but there's 8,000 of them. So 8,000 microsieverts is 8 millisieverts per hour. Always per hour. It should always be per hour if you're talking about a place, but they get this wrong sometimes. So here's the New York Times plotting, as a function of time, early this week, the radiation dose near the reactor at certain sites versus time. So Monday, there were little spikes of rate. Tuesday, there were little spikes of rate. Thursday, there were little. Tuesday, there were little spikes of big spikes of rate. This axis is supposedly saying 12 millisieverts per hour. And then up here, they say a measurement of 400 millisieverts was taken between two of the reactors. No, it wasn't. A measurement of 400 millisieverts per hour was taken between the reactors. This is a very common thing to get wrong, or maybe they're shorthanding it and not telling you. Elsewhere, and this is so. The reason we go through this is so you have some intuition for what these numbers mean. Radiation at 3 locations in Tokai, which is a ways away. Here's a spike to 0.005 millisieverts per hour. So that is not a large number. That's a small number. People far from the site have not been irradiated yet. Not yet. And they've been irradiated a little, so there, you can detect this. And this is done in some kind of radiation detector. So it's not zero. And one of the questions people always ask about radiation safety is, well, you're showing me all this data about Hiroshima survivors getting 1 sievert. Is the number of cancers you get from 1 person at 1 sievert the same as you get from having 10 people at a tenth of a sievert and 100 people at a hundredth of a sievert? I don't know. Probably this is a matter of some debate because there's just no data down here. There's no direct knowledge from epidemiology of a population that's all gotten 10 millisieverts in some way that you could follow them and see if they have a slightly tiny, tiny increase in what are already fairly rare cancers. So nobody really knows what goes on down here. The conservative assumption, and I think there is some evidence for it, but I'm not clear exactly how it works, is that this line is just proportional. So yeah, a tiny dose of radiation for a lot of people is the same as it gives the same number of cancers as a large dose for a few people, up to some limit where the people are just dead and they don't get cancer. But other people propose this threshold model where anything below 100 millisieverts per year is just not noticeable, but nobody really knows. The other thing people really know is, I said, when I show those cancer numbers, I said number of additional diagnoses per year. Is that for the rest of the life of the person who's been irradiated, or is it a spike that gets better over time, or is it even this? Is it that your rate of increase of cancer risk has increased, and so as you age, you become more and more susceptible? Nobody knows. There's absolutely no reliable data on this. I've seen hints that the line goes up and back down, but it's really not my specialty. Okay, so that's what a radiation dose means if you get one. Why are you going to get one? Or who's going to get one and from what? So here's the 3 populations of radioactivity. What's going to get out? This chart is singularly uninformative on the question because what you care about is the chemistry. Here's our periodic table. We've got hydrogen, helium, and so on. Here's our actinides down here. And here's where induced radioactivity shows up. stuff the reactor is made out of and some stuff in the air. Here's where fission products show up. Rubidium through indium-ish, iodine through gadolinium-ish are the sort of two populations of fission products. Very inexact picture here. And the actinides themselves are stuff sort of above and below uranium, all the way down to where it becomes stable again, which is lead. These are not technically actinides, and they behave a little differently. So how do you figure out what's going to get out of the reactor when it goes off? Well, I don't know. Let's look at the chemistry. And here's the chemistry. Roughly speaking, there's stuff in the middle. The actinides, most of the transition metals, they're metals. They behave like metals. They don't dissolve in water particularly well. They have high melting points and high boiling points. You can heat them up for a ways before they go into the atmosphere. There are a couple of things which are worse. Over here we have gases. Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and the noble gases, argon, xenon, radon, helium, are just gases at room temperature. If you have a bunch of gas in a bottle, it can just come off the top without too much trouble. There's a bunch of other stuff which is not actually gaseous, but is at least either sort of low boiling point or water soluble, or anyway, much more volatile than the metals. And that's a particular worry. So that gives you a guide to how stuff is going to come off of reactors. The gases are going to come off first. The water soluble or sort of generally mobile stuff is going to come off next. And this is, I think, what? Let's see, tellurium. This is technetium in the middle. It's a little more water soluble than most things. And the metals are hardest to liberate, so they're sort of safest. Very crude sketch of a generic reactor. You've got a pile of fuel, just all mixed together, and it's mixed together with its decay products. There's no way of separating them, so you just have this puddle of all kinds of hot stuff, you know, in a can. You don't want that in contact with the water, so you surround it with this zirconium alloy, which is particularly good at withstanding radiation and being in contact with water. And that thing is sitting there being hot. If the reactor is healthy, there are some activation products out here, and that's your sort of routine radiation release from a reactor. But in the environment, there's really practically nothing outside of here. So when there's a, let's see, I had a note on this. When there's a meltdown, what happens is this gets so hot, you lose some of the coating. So some of this protective zirc alloy comes off or splits or dissolves or burns somehow. And so some of this fuel has gotten out and liquefied, or at least lost its structure. This is probably not a good picture. So stuff that can get into the water is now in the water. Cesium, iodine, that's all floating around in here. Stuff that can get into gas form, which probably also includes some iodine, is in the gas. But if your containment vessel is still intact, there's still nothing in the environment. You have a hot tank, and you don't care about the details. If you're 3 Mile Island, the next thing that happens is that the pressure in the tank is too high, so you vent it. You don't vent the bottom, you don't want this water to come out, but you do have to vent the gas on top. 3 Mile Island was a nuclear accident involving a meltdown of the fuel. So a bunch of it puddled up in the reactor. Pressure rose in the containment vessel, and the operators were forced to, or decided to, or I actually don't know the details. They somehow had to vent this headspace to get the pressure down. So at 3 Mile Island, all this stuff that was in the steam got into the environment. So there's a big release of radioactive krypton, xenon, some radon. And that was it. Thereafter, this was shut off, this was cooled down somehow or other, and we were left with a big tank full of radioactive stuff, but not all that much radiation release by reactor standards. What's going on at the Fukushima site is that something else has breached in this containment, and we'll learn more about this. I am so far from an expert on this. But roughly speaking, this gives you access to many more routes for stuff to get out of the fuel, including things that don't particularly volatilize, like maybe technetium, but that dissolve in water. So whatever water is escaping, and I don't know the details of this, whatever water is escaping is allowing, has the potential to allow more radionuclei to get out, and so that's step two. These are still mostly fission products, still beta decay stuff. Where things get worse is when the fuel is on fire, and there may be reports as of very recently today that some of the fuel is on fire. It wasn't clear as of a few days ago. Fuel is on fire means oxygen's gotten in here. Hot fuel is exposed. There's no water covering it up or cooling it down. And metals do burn. They are flammable. They would rather be oxidized than metallic. And this is bad, because once you're oxidizing stuff, well, fission products can oxidize, actinides can oxidize, and they all form smoke, and the smoke is radioactive, and that's your problem. That's the serious problem. And that's where a Three Mile Island-like no detectable cancer sort of event turns into the crisis that's happening now. This is very bad, but still not as bad as Chernobyl. How was Chernobyl worse? Well, how wasn't Chernobyl worse? There wasn't a containment vessel of any sort. The lid just popped off when the pressure increased. The core was conveniently filled with graphite. Graphite's flammable. It's like coal. It's like take a bunch of hot uranium, ramp it up to 400 megawatts, and then pour it on top of a mountain of anthracite coal, and let it set on fire. And that's what happened at Chernobyl. So not only was Chernobyl burning like crazy, but the reactor was fissioning. It was on. It was a working power reactor producing fissions right up to the last second, and possibly afterwards. I'm not entirely clear on that point. By contrast, Fukushima was turned off when the earthquake happened, and it's been off for 5 days. It is a warm reactor, but it is not an operating reactor. In the case of Chernobyl, this is a picture of the site from above. This is just off Wikipedia, which has a very good article on the topic, as far as I can tell. I've zoomed in here. You see this little ring? That's the lid of the reactor sitting there open. And if you look down here, you're looking into the bowels of a live reactor. This was all an explosion followed by enormous fire. There's a big plume of smoke that went up, and the smoke was what carried most of the radiation dose into the atmosphere, which then starts falling down all over the neighborhood. And putting this out required just absolutely incredible sacrifice. So why is Fukushima not that bad, and why is it not that bad? A couple of saving graces. The reactor survived the earthquake intact. It was a 9.0 magnitude earthquake and a bunch of reactors sitting right on top, and nothing tipped over, nothing cracked in half. And except for the tsunami, things were looking rather good. They shut down properly. They inserted their control rods, turned off their fission reactions, and then they survived a couple of days before any of these breaches started. And that's a really remarkable thing. These fission products, remember, you've been manufacturing fission products as long as you've been generating power. They're all radioactive, so they're all eventually going to decay. But a whole lot of them decay pretty fast. So this is a graph of how much radioactive power there is as a function of time. It's a log scale. So here's an hour, here's a day, here's a week, here's a month after you've turned off a reactor. So the fact that Fukushima was off for at least an hour saved a factor of 5 on amount of harmful stuff in the fuel relative to Chernobyl. Survived for a day, that's a factor of 20. Another thing that's worth noting is the thing that's catching on fire right now is not live fuel. It's a 100-day-old spent fuel station. That's 100 times less radioactive than Chernobyl was in fission products. So that's a stroke of luck there. It didn't have to work out that way. Another thing that's really a tremendous saving grace is the presence of an evacuation. Fairly prompt and maybe not thorough enough, we'll see, but certainly a nearby evacuation. By contrast, at Chernobyl, there was a city of 50,000 people, 3-4 kilometers away from the site. They weren't evacuated until the next day. In the 30-kilometer zone around Chernobyl, there were another 30,000 people who weren't evacuated for 2 weeks. All this radioactive smoke raining down on their heads. It was really very, very bad. It was as bad as it could be. I found a quote in one of my books. 5 days after the fire, Russian officers coming up to a woman who is eventually going to be told to evacuate. She asks what's going on. She says, "Don't worry, just keep on milking your cow." And she kept on milking her cow, and the cows turned out to be the source of all the iodine that was going into the kids that gave them thyroid cancer. So nuclides to watch. What are you watching out for in the news? What's coming out of this reactor? Here's some of the moderately volatile stuff that certainly should be coming out now. Iodine-131 is what caused most of the cancers at Chernobyl. There's a lot of it released. A lot of it got into people via this cow route. The iodine falls on the ground, cows eat the grass, iodine goes into the milk, kid drinks the milk. And there were people, survivors actually, who had doses of 100 sieverts to their thyroid. Remember, 5 sieverts in the whole body is fatal. 100 sieverts in the thyroid gives you thyroid cancer pretty much right away. But there are survivors with that sort of condition. It's a short half-life. It's not that, you know, you don't have to run away for too long, and it'll go away on its own. Iodine rained out all over Eastern Europe, and that was rather quickly. In those first 8 days, there was about a half millisievert to just sort of everybody in Bulgaria. Lots of Eastern Europe had this. Cesium and strontium are sort of the worst of the crew. They spread widely. They're very mobile. The rest of Eastern Europe, so add in the cesium dose and you get another millisievert over the next 30 years while this stuff is still around. It is still around. It's still detectable. Strontium, similar. There's less of it, but it accumulates in bone in particular when you ingest it. Neither of them are all that mobile, so I don't think they migrate in groundwater too badly. Plutonium-241 comes out later. There's a lot of it, lots of it, a little shorter half-life. And for reasons I'll talk about, it's easier to decontaminate. When the fire starts, as the fire may have already started, is when you remember, these reactors aren't out to produce strontium. They're not out to produce iodine. They're out to run just as much fission as possible, which means they really want as much short-lived radioactivity as they can get. You know, you want to pump all of your uranium down into this chain and get it stable as fast as possible. So there's lots and lots of stuff in that collection with very short half-lives. If you have a lot of stuff with a short half-life, it means it has to get rid of itself really fast, which means it goes decay, 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 decay. Very fast decays means lots of radioactivity per unit stuff. So here, this is just some of the things most abundant in Chernobyl soot. Some of it very short-lived, 3 days, but that's tremendously, tremendously radioactive. 30 days, 60 days, and you have to leave town for a while before a 60-day element will have decayed, you know, multiple times, or such that it's really all gone. Nice thing about the soot is it doesn't go as far as the volatiles. The krypton goes all around the Earth, doesn't last that long. The strontium seems to go further for reasons that aren't entirely clear to me. The soot can get rained out, so it settled down near the reactor. It settled on the heads of the first responders. They were just, their clothes, their bodies, their hair were just covered in this kind of stuff. And this is why you're so concerned about the fire at Fukushima. Not because you're afraid the plume is going to get to Tokyo, although you should be afraid a bit. You should worry about it because you can't send firemen into a cloud of smoke containing this pile of radioactivity. Radiation is a stochastic process. It's an even worse description, isn't it? It happens if you have a pile of 1,000 atoms. You have a pile of 1,000 zirconium atoms, and you wait 60 days. What you have now is a pile of 500 zirconium atoms. The other half have decayed already. You wait another 60 days. Well, you hand that to somebody else and say, aha, I have a pile of 500 zirconium atoms. They wait 60 days and they have 250. They hand that off to somebody else. They say, oh, I've got 250 sodium atoms. So half-life is the time for half of it to go away. That is an absolutely perfect curve all the way out. There's no deviation from that half. So don't expect there to be, after 5 half-lives, it's really all gone. No, after 5 half-lives, 2^5 of it is gone. All but 1/32 is out. So this gives you, so something with a 60-day half-life, you're going to want to wait for 60 days times 5, 6, 10, 8 before you want to come back and have contact with it. So when we're talking about smoke, that's what these stay indoors advisories are all about, and that's why they should be taken seriously. I forget who the U.S. Homeland Security guy was who told you to put duct tape on your doors if there was ever a bioterrorism incident. Nobody took that too seriously. When the Japanese authorities say stay indoors because of the radiation, this is what they mean. If there is soot falling on the driveway, it's decaying and it's giving a huge radiation dose to your driveway. And that doesn't bother you. It does behave like soot. It doesn't behave like a gas. So it mostly falls down. So if you're staying indoors, it's not falling on you. And it's not giving you a dose. So, I mean, there are defenses against this kind of stuff. They aren't accessible to the first responders, but they're accessible to people in the cities. The other nice thing about soot is it's compared to strontium, compared to cesium, it's easy to clean. It takes time, but you can clean it up, you can wash it off of surfaces, you can brush it into a can. And you can restore a soot-contaminated city to a livable state with respect to this soot to a certain extent. Agriculture, fisheries, I mean, Chernobyl spent a lot of effort cleaning up, trying to clean up a lot of agricultural areas, the prime farmland. A lot of what they had to do was just dig up the topsoil, put it in a truck, and get rid of it. Sometimes you can turn it over, just kind of hide the radioactivity a little deeper. It's not you're hiding it forever. You want to hide it for the couple of years it takes for it not to be a problem anymore. The other thing to remember about this kind of table is, unlike chemical hazards, you don't care about each of these elements separately. You know, if I tell you that you need to avoid, you know, mercury, and you need to avoid PCBs, and you need to avoid, plastic bottles, because they have this arsenic derivative in them. You have to avoid each of those things separately, and there's a whole list of separate little chemicals that you would worry about, and you need to worry about each of them. Radioactivity, you don't need to worry about each separate little thing. You need to worry about your dose, your total dose. So you add it all up, and it doesn't matter where it came from. You might worry about your dose to your thyroid, and your dose to your bones, your dose to your skin. They might be a little different, but for the most part, you just need to add these things up. So that's all I had prepared. I wanted to say that a funny thing that happened in the wake of Chernobyl was, at least by the standards of the Soviet Union, a lot of decent epidemiological work was done on people who were exposed to this radiation. That's how we know about the large number of thyroid cancers. I don't know if people believe these numbers, but the 10,000, maybe 20,000 thyroid cancers caused by Chernobyl. One of the funny things that epidemiological survey found was very few cancers, but absolutely terrible health outcomes. They found lots of depression, they found lots of PTSD, they found lots of stress, lots of fear, because nobody told them anything. They were told, your town has been hit by a reactor and we are trucking you all to Kiev. Leave everything behind and go, and then get a handshake and see you later. They were not explained. Nobody explained to them what a sievert was. Nobody, you know, explained to them that they could get rid of the lead by washing their hair. They were just baffled, and so they spend the rest of their lives thinking that the reactor is slowly killing them, whether or not it is. So this was a huge educational communication failure, and it's absolutely unnecessary. It's an absolutely avoidable tragedy, and that's part of the reason I'm here. You all have the information. Your friends and acquaintances in Japan should have the information. You don't need to listen to authorities that tell you whether you should worry about whatever dose you have. Let's say, count the millisieverts. Count them yourself. They'll be in the paper. You can get a Geiger counter. You can measure them. And you decide what your risk tolerance is. You decide how to respond. That's something that the people at Chernobyl were not given a chance to think about. My feeling is that the worst case radiation hazards from Fukushima are local, they're bad, very bad, very locally, somewhat bad in a somewhat broader region, but still confined to part of Japan, and for the most part they're mitigatable. The cities that get hit by this badly will be cleaned up. Tokyo is not going to be abandoned. And the worst part, the best parts of that mitigation have already happened, and the early evacuation is, by God, the best thing that could be done. You don't have to worry about soot falling on empty houses, no matter how much of it there is. Chernobyl didn't have that luxury. People were already there when the smoke started falling. The next thing that we will need is watch out for if iodine-131 levels go up. Chernobyl, that all came in through food. Don't take an iodine tablet and keep drinking the milk. Just stop drinking the damn milk. But that needs to come from the government. That needs to be somebody credible putting restrictions on things and making sure, you know, unscrupulous farmers aren't selling meat on the black market or something like this. My feeling is also that the global radiation hazard is nil. These are large numbers of radiation, but the Earth is a large place, and there's lots of radiation here already. There's no evidence that this large amount of radiation, when it's spread over the world, as say the krypton radon dose will, has any health hazards that are measurable in any way at all. So my feeling is this is really, really zero. California does not have to worry. Korea does not have to worry. China does not have to worry. Even Tokyo, so we'll talk about, Tokyo is not so far from Fukushima, a plume in the wrong direction, really bad luck on the weather. So, you know, you watch the news and go indoors if you're told to. If you believe in the linear dose response relationship, you should say, wait, how can a small dose given to a billion people is the same as a huge dose given to a million people? So how can you say that it's not a problem? I'd say if you're really worried about extremely low-level radiation causing very, very low-level cancer, the best way to stop that is to stop burning coal, not to stress out about exactly what's happening here. Moreover, you know, we all have a limited amount of kind of psychic energy for worrying about things. It's a stressful thing. It takes energy. Takes energy for us. Takes energy for our friends in Japan. My message anyway. This is just not a departmental statement. This is my personal statement. You should save your energy for the people affected by the tsunami, and for the real radiation hazard, which is the 50. Maybe now 100 plant workers who are still at Fukushima putting out the fires. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming. So, one before we start the Q&A, Theophanes would like to give a quick update on the status of the reactor. You can take the microphone. And here's the pointer.
In any case, I thought it would be useful to have up there, the pointer is this one?
Yes.
To have up there the geometry of concern here with this reactor. And most of the time, of course, we want to spend to answer your questions. But the latest is the following. The initial problem was with the containment, which is this part here. What you see here is the reactor vessel. And this is surrounded by that shell, and that communicates with this torus. It's like a donut that is all around. So this is what you call primary containment. So if this is integral, any radioactivity that is here is just like what Ben was showing, the little can, contains everything. Now, at the beginning, of course, the problems arose because there was no power to cool these reactors. So the fuel became exposed, and the fuel started overheating. And then the zirconium that was there started oxidizing. And the hydrogen came out in this area here. And then it came out in this area here through those vents that you see here. And it looks to me now like, they haven't talked about it yet, but it looks to me that this chamber here was slightly damaged from the earthquake. So that when hydrogen started coming out of here, then we had an explosion in this room, and this caused a subsequent failure of this container. This is not good news because now we lost our primary containment. Still, I remind everybody that in order for radioactivity to come from here to the outside, it has to go through the water that is in there. And that water has a retention property. It has a property of keeping a lot of radioactivity inside. However, this property is lost very quickly when this water gets overheated and gets near boiling. Still, it has some retention property, but it is not as good as if the water was cold. Now, suddenly, as of yesterday or maybe a day and a half ago, however, my concerns and the people that are involved in this sort of following it shifted radically from the reactor to this area here, which is the spent fuel pool. This has become a major problem because it looks like in the fourth reactor, you remember there are six reactors there, there are three reactors which were suffering because they were operating. So those are the reactors that were shut down, and now we had to deal with the decay heat, as you just heard. And the other three reactors were essentially without any fuel in them. All of a sudden now we hear that in the fourth reactor, we had an explosion at the top of the fuel pool. Now, why this is a concern? The concern is that there is a huge amount of fuel that is held in here, typically from anywhere from 4 to 6 cores. So that's equivalent to like a 6 reactors at the most, fully radioactive contained in those pools. And so that's the fourth reactor, which had shown up to this point no indication of difficulty. Now we have fire on the top of the pool, and we have an explosion, which destroys the roof of this building here, which is called the secondary containment. So to me, that's a very big concern because this pool here, once it is lost the water and lost cooling ability, the zirconium, the cladding, oxidizes, and that becomes autocatalytic. Actually, near the end, when there's still some water vaporizing, that adds to the fire, so to speak, and is almost like catches fire. Then that creates a big spike on the release of radioactivity. All right, so now what the situation is the following. Reactors 1 and 3 have lost those pools, and the fuel is basically destroyed in there. Reactor number 4, the same situation. Reactors, I think I wrote it down here, reactors 5 and 6, which again, they're not operating reactors. They're right now, these pools are overheating. The good news is that the rod opened. So now they have access by the rod. So they can bring fire trucks. And also I just heard like half an hour ago, just before we came here, they got electricity. They have electric power now. So those are very positive news. The question now is going to be, and this morning actually I was trying to puzzle, how do we cool those pools up here? And I sort of had been advising through some channels that they consult with me for the government, I've been advising that to be ready, if necessary, to controllably collapse this whole pool into the floor. Because as long as it's sitting up there, there's no way to cover it. And if you cannot, earlier on, about a day ago, I said, why don't you get helicopters to dump water on the top? Well, they wouldn't let helicopters fly because the level of radiation was too high. So that was no gainer. So if that doesn't happen, the only other way to do is to bring the fuel down. And again, remember, the main thing is to cover things with water as deeply as we can. And there is a lot of water there. Now they have access with the fire engines, and they can do that. And then in that case, what would that require would be to basically controllably with explosives to cut out through these floors, the floors cut through, and then cut this pool, come down. Another concern that we have, and is not clear yet, is that because there is plutonium also in this, some of those are mixed oxide, some of this fuel, because it's plutonium, there is a possibility if it is gotten into certain configurations to become very critical. So it can be critical. If it's critical, then it can just go off with, again, going into fission. And that's a very bad thing. We want to make sure we are avoiding that. So just very shortly, the message is that I feel pretty reasonable about this area here. Right now, my major acute concern is about this and about all the 6 reactors. And hopefully nothing will happen to interrupt. They brought fire hoses that have cannons that they can shoot water at 200 meters. But the problem is that they have so much debris on the top that this water cannot get into the pool. So now they have to, and I hear that they're trying to send people up there to clear out the debris. So it's very, very difficult problem. And finally, one last thing to mention is that according to analysis were done in this country, again, there was hardly any cooperation because they basically did not give us information and they sort of held like that. Only now, finally, they said, yeah, we want now to cooperate, and is now just beginning this process. But already the NRC here, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, took the position that it was a mistake to evacuate only 30 kilometers. Based on analysis that are done in this country relative to dispersal of radioactivity, they say a minimum of like 80 kilometers should have been the radius of evacuation. My concern is that if this problem becomes exaggerated, and if the weather shifts, right now the winds are going east, which is very nice. If the weather shifts, I think we could have real problems. Now, I'll leave it at that. Let's leave this up here just in case questions, we can point to things here.
Thanks, Odie. Patrick? Yeah, so we have myself, Theo, and Patrick McCray from the Department of History are happy to answer questions. And I think since this is being recorded, it'll all be on the web sometime tomorrow, slides and audio. And if we pass you the microphone, then your questions will also be on the web, which I think will be useful. So, yeah. Is there? Yeah, there's a microphone over here. If you could pass that over.
How come they are not using robots, since they cannot send people there? They could be robots doing the work of the firefighting.
Remember now, this is all darkened out. This is the help that is needed is up here. The roof has collapsed in some of those reactors. How are you going to use the robots? The difficulty is in getting water up there. And in order to get water up there, either you have to connect lines, and again, this has been obviously, that's why the system failed, because normally these pools are being cooled. The reason that they are losing water is because the heat cannot be removed, and gradually they come up in temperature, they begin to boil. So the robot is not an option here.
Even to remove the debris, to open up so the water could go in?
So at Chernobyl, the people who were assigned to clearing debris from the roof were referred to as bio-robots.
Could you extrapolate any of these conclusions to San Onofre or Diablo Canyon, both of which are in seismically active areas?
Which conclusions? You say extrapolate conclusions. You mean what? We didn't draw any conclusions here except to tell you that there are some problems that still need to be resolved for this case here. So maybe you can rephrase your question.
San Onofre, I think, is a pressurized water reactor.
Yeah, so but I want to hear the question exactly what
if
the question
is. If there were a significant earthquake in Southern California, how much radiation would be released? San Onofre is in a heavily urbanized area. Diablo Canyon, not so, but they happen to be both relatively close to Santa Barbara, so I'm just curious how we might be affected by radiation.
I think I can try this and you go. A nuclear reactor, such as any of those reactors, light water reactors, needs to be cooled after it's shut down. There's always a possibility of an extreme earthquake that will disable systems, just like happened here. That will not be possible to keep cooling the reactor. If that becomes impossible, then there will be a meltdown. The meltdown will penetrate eventually the containment. So in those, because of the design of those reactors, you're not going to have the same intensity as you have, for example, from these suppression pools. The spent fuel pools. The containment design is also very different. It's a dry containment, we call it. It's more robust. It can take much more pressure. It's more controllable. You can vent it to the outside. If you have hydrogen, for example, the hydrogen will go outside and will explode outside if it needs to explode. So I will say that one can envision situations where also pressurized water reactors can show a very adverse response. Because what comes along with an earthquake is not only the damage to some components, the control system is lost, power is lost, infrastructure is lost. The problem here was the infrastructure was lost to the point where people couldn't get there with trucks, only just now gained access to the road. So every low probability, what I like to say is every low probability event is sort of totally unexpected. And don't think of something happening in San Onofre or Double Canyon, there'll be anything like this. The question more like is, what would be the other next low probability event that we must protect against? And that is a much more general question. And what I call that defense in depth. One should have, we have prevention, we have mitigation, we have emergency response, and I've been advocating for quite a long time that we should have basically rock bottom defense for all those reactors. Like everything else fails, there is an ultimate boundary, a defense. One thing, I did a study here for, actually for exactly this design for the US 25 years ago, exactly for these kinds of things. And we said that if you have a meltdown, you fill up this area, this container, you fill it up with water, and if you did that, you're going to prevent an immediate failure of this container. If you didn't fill it, the melt would go there, would penetrate through the boundary of the shell, and then you get released to the outside. And this became part of the procedures, actually. They have the same procedures. However, if you don't have ability to put the water there, so when you have a major event, many other things break along the way, and that is why we went in this country for passive reactors, where actually virtually you can walk away. So we have now both pressurized water reactors and boiling water reactors that are completely passive. But again, it is not to say that even these passive plants, there will not be a challenge that will fail them.
I've heard that Hiroshima may well underestimate cancers because the living conditions were such that only a really robust subset of the people survived to get cancer in the first place.
I'm not an expert on that topic at all. I'm sorry, I can't comment.
I guess I have two questions. One, we hear a lot of reports about the color of the smoke coming out of the reactor. Sort of, how can we decipher that information sort of intelligently?
And how do you what?
Yeah. Secondly, with the salt water being poured onto the containment, what sort of risk do you see with that directly contaminating sort of sea life? And if you could maybe expound on what contaminants may enter the water and sort of the causal procedure there and risks.
Well, right now, our problem is to get the water in there, and there is not much water leaving the place. It will be a long time before any water actually leaves the place. Ultimately, we have to be concerned about what happens to all this water. We have to be concerned whether the melt, because I expect that the melt is going to penetrate this vessel. Maybe already did some of it, we don't know yet. But eventually, I think it's going to penetrate, because already in two of those reactors, the core geometry has been lost completely. And when that happens, there's no way to cool the fuel. The fuel just keeps going down. Okay, and eventually we'll have to come out here. Again, another issue we have with our present reactors, again, I raised that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but it's too much of a difficult thing, I guess, for the industry and the regulators to deal with. We still don't know for our reactors, and still remains a problem for me, is that if you have a meltdown, whether you can put all the water here you want, whether that will keep the fuel from keep going down into the concrete. We still don't know that. And I had suggested to actually put in some systems that will actually stop from doing that. But that's a pretty serious thing. Oh, that's exactly what happened in Chernobyl. It just, the remaining, what little was left there even, most of it went up. Whatever little was left, it kept going down.
On the other hand, at Three Mile Island, the core puddled, and it stayed in the containment vessel.
In Three Mile Island, it came within a nanometer from going through, because it just was lucky. He pushed the button and started the pumps, and stopped it about 20% of the melt only actually came down to the lower head and was cooled there. I think in this case, this is not happening. Another thing I should mention, that again, we mentioned this concern, but of course, there's no options at this point. But when you put in a boiling system, you put salt water, and you keep boiling, what happens? You accumulate salt. Eventually, that salt is going to fill up. Already based on the estimations that we have, how long they've been feeding and how much they've been boiling, there's a lot of salt in those cores. And we don't know how much of it is plugged up. That is going to interfere with the cooling also.
Yes, I have a question. So just an update, there were some videos online an hour ago of helicopters dropping water on the pools. That's just the latest I saw 1 hour ago.
1 hour ago?
There were military helicopters dropping water. And so my question is, the power stations, when they're operating, they're nominally around 500 megawatts each. And you mentioned there were around six cores stored in the spent fuel ponds.
In one of those.
Yeah.
And there are six of those.
Right. So when the fission reaction stops, the power goes down from 450 megawatts. My question is, what is the power of the spent fuel that's in the ponds right now? What power of, so how much water do we need to dump on those things to keep them from burning?
As you heard also earlier from Ben, the power is very low. Nevertheless, it is of the order of magnitude that if you leave it for like a day and a half, it will dry out. That's really what happened in reactor number four. They, in the reactor number three, I believe, number four, they have a core that is only 4 weeks old. That's the newest core that they have. At 4 weeks old, you get about 0.1%, it's right there. We were estimating that earlier, about 0.1% of the decay power. So if it is 1/10 of a percent, so 400 megawatts, if it's 400, it would be like 0.4 megawatts. And while some reactors are 700, so it would be 0.7 megawatts. It still is not negligible, 700 kilowatts, a lot of power.
Thanks.
And again, that's only from one, I'm sorry, this is only from one of the cores, so you have to multiply times six to get the total demand for the pool for heat removal.
So to stop the fission from reoccurring with the spent fuel, couldn't you grind up boron and just mix it in with the fuel to capture the neutrons?
Our problem is not with the fission power. Already the fission is shut down. In fact, they shut down in all the reactors right after the earthquake. So there's no fission. It's just all the decay power that we heard earlier in the Ben's talk that this is going to keep producing. It has nothing to do with fission.
But you mentioned that the fission may occur if you don't keep the fuel separate.
If the stuff came down and get into an unfavorable geometrical configuration because of the presence of plutonium, then you can get the critical. How are you going to go in there? You have to, if you have boron, you have to put it inside of that hot inferno. Not so easy. But maybe that's not such a big problem, because I just heard that in reactor number four, they think that the fuel in the pool already collapsed and nothing happened. It looks like it already melted. The question is when that's going to go through now the bottom, because it will go through the bottom eventually.
Is it not possible to design protective suits that would allow people to go in without damage?
To stop, so for alpha radiation, we've got our three types of radiation. For the alpha particles themselves, a bunny suit is fine. This cloth will stop them. Betas and gammas, to stop half of the gammas, you need about 3 centimeters of lead. So no, it's not really feasible at all. Even in nuclear, in real nuclear cleanup scenarios, it's very difficult even to build robotics because electronics don't survive. I was watching videos recently of the robots being used to clean up radioactive waste sites at the Hanford lab. They have to build all hydraulic robots because they cannot put cannot put electronics into these high radiation environments. That would have been, that probably would have been true on the roof of Chernobyl, and I suspect it's true in some of these environments also. I think the historian would like to say a few words.
Sure. So Ben didn't invite me here just to be a moral support. He actually asked me to say something verging on intelligent. I tend to think about this, I guess, through a different lens, and that's not thinking about it in the sense of 2011, but thinking about it more from maybe the framework of 1954. And the reason I picked that is threefold. In 1954, that's when Japan's nuclear power program actually started. And 8 years after the start of that program, they had a working reactor that was initially started with help from the British, which in some ways, both direct and indirectly, leads us to today. But in another way, and I think it's what's important, is that Japan's nuclear history is very different from our own. We don't think of World War II as a nuclear war, but that's how it ended. And Japan's experience with that was very different, obviously, than ours. But in 1954 also, there was a time when there were lots of nuclear tests being done around the world, and there was one specifically in the South Pacific, a test called Bravo, that resulted in explosive power about 2.5 times greater than what the physicists and engineers in the United States working on the project thought would happen. As a result of that, a Japanese fishing boat was contaminated with radioactive fallout. It went back to Japan. One of the crew members died, and it sparked a panic in Japan because, obviously, the Japanese depended heavily upon fishing stocks, and there were concerns about that. But the third touch point, coming back also to 1954, is that's also when the movie Godzilla was released. And the fact that you're laughing makes my point for me, which was in the United States, this was seen as sort of a cartoonish film of a guy in a rubber suit walking around smashing buildings, models in Tokyo. But in Japan, the movie was seen very differently. It was seen as a drama, a serious exploration of Japan's relationship both with the nuclear age, but also a way of exploring how this society that was transitioning after World War II was going to come to grips with modern science. So those are just three different perspectives, I guess, I could offer.
Thank you, Patrick. So maybe we have time for approximately one more question, and then we'll let you go.
I'm proud to have the last question, because I'm an architect and a planner. And I'd like to know the panel's feeling of reactors as the supplier of energy for our communities in the future. Let's go from 1954 now to 2050 or 2040. And let's talk about the spent rods in terrorism and the idea of containing those rods and where they go and what are we doing to our environment. And is the reactor the idea of the perfect power supplier in the future?
Maybe I can say that, answer that first. It would be nice if we could design a reactor that didn't have radioactive waste that came out. That would be the perfect power supplier for the future. There are technologies that get remarkably close. Nothing that exists now, but there's discussion of something called accelerator transmutation of waste, which is expensive, but you can completely destroy. You can take any fuel, any mixture, put it into this thing, and it burns it back to the line of stability. At a cost of, I think you reuse 10% of your power in the sort of recirculator, and you can destroy all your fuel with no proliferation hazard because it doesn't make plutonium. There are new reactor cycles that are designed not to make plutonium, and so there are avenues towards solving the proliferation problem. The thing we do not have is an avenue for producing non-fossil fuel electricity, which in every possible measure, in damage to the environment and damage to human health, in millisieverts, the impact of coal-based electricity on our environment is absolutely horrific. And that's the right way to make the comparison. It's not just is nuclear bad, but yes, there are bad things about it, but is it worse than the alternatives? Given that the alternative at the moment is coal, yes, it's nuclear, I think, is much, much better than the alternatives. Waste disposal is something I take some interest in. It's an evolving problem, and there are not great answers yet, except for going to new fuel cycles. I think those cycles are on the horizon. It'd be nice if we started building reactors again so we could actually implement one of them.
Again, I'd just like to add a couple of things to that. First of all, I think it's a major mistake and it's a major incongruency to have nuclear power and not have the ability to reprocess. That all that creates is a huge amount of fuel that is lying around in pools, and it keeps on adding and adding and adding, and nobody wants to dispose of it. So we are creating a huge problem by this, first. Secondly, about the future of nuclear power, I want to say that the whole thing needs to be rethought. The infrastructure basically was destroyed in this country in the last 20 or 30 years because of the way that nuclear power was handled politically and the way that the other forces played into that. Personally, I left actually the field of practicing nuclear safety about 10 years ago. Unilaterally, I left because I just became sick of the way that things were being done. I think we have major problems in our institutions, and that means regulatory institutions, governmental policy-making institutions, on the other hand, the industrial institutions. And they all need to come to a new reckoning of how they are going to behave, how they're going to organize, and how they're going to go forward in a real secure way that makes sense. So you don't have things like this happening in this country or in other places as well. And that creates a lot of competing forces because there's economics. You try to ask to protect for earthquake 9 is going to cost you not the same as you protect for earthquake 7. And now then already 10 years ago, nuclear was not competitive, so now you're asking, how are you going to do that? So it's the same thing like you're killing it. So, but I think, personally, I believe that the whole thing needs to be rethought, and I have great doubts whether, as a country, given how the whole political situation is, we're able to do that even. So it's not a good story.
And that about, I think that not a good story pretty much sums up the the talk.